ComingToBook.com.
Hello once again, everybody, and thank you for joining me here on this Thursday, March 21st edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour or so, as we go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Glad to have you with me. It is March Madness. I'm recording this just before March Madness starts, but wanted to make sure I got Christian Pina's UFC segment out for you today, and figure while I'm going to go ahead and do that, might as well do some Major League Baseball stuff, talking about the National League Central Division here on today's program. So no guests. I'm going to talk about the NL Central. Then I'm going to put that segment with Christian into the recording here. That was done on Skype. It's going to sound different than Blog Talk Radio. I apologize for that, but you know, obviously with so much going on here today with March Madness and all the stuff I've been working on here this morning, just doing the best I can to get something out to you. So hopefully it's not too bad, but just wanted to let you know that at the top of today's show. Over at bangthebook.com, we are your one-stop shop for sports betting news and information. Tons and tons of great stuff being done by our cast of writers over there, getting everybody together to preview all of these March Madness games for us, all the first-round games Thursday, Friday. Then we'll do the second-round games Saturday and Sunday. Of course, then we're off until Thursday with the Sweet 16 on Thursday and Friday. But we'll have a lot of great content for you next week on Bang the Book Radio, including some thoughts on the NIT, CBI, CIT, and of course the Sweet 16, the Elite Eight, all that type of stuff. But also over there in print form, or I guess in virtual print form, my 30 MLB season win total previews. Also, I did my National League East MLB betting tips and players to watch for the five teams there in the senior circuit. So you check both of those out over at bangthebook.com as well. You can get my guide on Amazon as a Kindle ebook or right on the homepage at bangthebook.com. You can download the PDF. Certainly we'd appreciate it if you support the site by downloading that guide over on Amazon. But if you just want the PDF, that's perfectly fine too. And you know, if you don't have a Kindle or a Fire or anything like that, you can still get apps on your Android or iPhone that would be Kindle accessible to check out that MLB betting guide. Very proud of what we put together here this year. Yes, I know for those that downloaded it early, the Cubs and the White Sox are flipped by league. The Cubs, unfortunately, in the AL Central, the White Sox in the NL Central. Formatting company did fix that. So if you download automatic, or if you turn on automatic updates for Kindle, it should download the updated version for you. If you're somebody who downloaded it a little bit later, you have no idea what the hell I'm talking about, and that's perfectly fine. As you know, this and every edition of Bang the Book Radio presented by our friends over at DSI Sportsbook. BTB200 is that promo code, 100% deposit match bonus for the sportsbook, 100% deposit match bonus for the live casino at BetDSI. It's only a game until you bet it. And of course, as you know, Kyle Hunter's daily college basketball picks, Parker Michaels' daily NHL picks, lots of great stuff going on over at bangthebook.com, so make sure that you check all of it out. All right, let's take a look here at the National League Central, and I'll probably put something together tomorrow on the National League West, as we're just 1 week away from opening day for 28 teams. Mariners already 2-0, A's already 0-2, which is a bummer for my favorite season win total pick here, but not worried about the A's at all. Just a very unique atmosphere, a very unique environment over there in Japan. But the five teams here in the National League Central, all very, very interesting. All pretty damn good, too. I mean, this is a league where the lowest season win total, the Pittsburgh Pirates at 77.5, really can't say that about any other division here in Major League Baseball for this season. So the Central looks to be very, very competitive. Will be a division I talk about a lot on the Bettors Box here as we go throughout the spring and summer. But we'll go in alphabetical order once again here, beginning with the Chicago Cubs. 95-68 last year. They lost game 163 to the Brewers, then went on to lose the wild card game to the Rockies. Their season win total, 88.5. I had a listener question maybe a month or so ago about the Cubs' Pecota projection and just how low it was in the 80 and 82 range, also seeing them at 79 and 83. And, you know, we saw a very significant update over at FanGraphs a couple of days ago. They've added catcher framing metrics to the WAR calculations for catchers and have sort of factored that more into the equation. And what we're finding is that catcher framing is a really, really big deal. And based on the findings that have been done by a lot of very, very smart people in the baseball community, it's something that matters. It's something that is quite significant. And I talked about that when I answered the Monday mailbag question regarding the Cubs' Pecota projection about Wilson Contreras and about the fact that Wilson Contreras is a very bad pitch framer. So that was definitely factored into the equation over at Pecota and over at Baseball Prospectus. Now, furthermore, the Cubs have some big concerns with their starting staff. You know, last year they were third in, this is overall as a pitching staff, the Cubs were third in ERA, third in left on base percentage, but they were 18th in FIP and 22nd in XFIP. So a lot of their guys, lower ERAs, higher FIPs, higher XFIPs, more often than not, you're going to see regression from those guys. Now, you look at John Lester, for example. He's probably the poster boy of this. 3.32 ERA, 4.39 FIP, 4.43 XFIP, 80.3% left on base percentage with a low strikeout rate. If you're a guy that misses a lot of bats, you can carry a high left on base percentage. If you don't, it's much, much harder. Unless you're elite from a contact management standpoint, it is very, very difficult for you to strand a lot of runners. Lester, okay in the contact management department, not nearly as good as you would expect a guy with an 80.3% left on base percentage and a 3.32 ERA with a 4.39 FIP to be. So Lester is a regression candidate. Jose Quintana the last 2 years, back-to-back years with FIPs over 4, last year 4.43. That's not great. Kyle Hendricks is still going to carry a low ERA, high XFIP because of the nature in which he pitches. And you know, he's a guy that I think we've just kind of come to terms with the fact that his command is so good that he's going to be one of those guys that perennially will outpitch his advanced metrics. And it is hard to get to that point with guys that you can trust to post low ERAs with higher FIPs and higher XFIPs. But a guy like Kyle Hendricks, definitely one that stands out. But overall, a lot of guys from last year's Cubs pitching staff, and you can go through and look, go over to FanGraphs, look at their pitching stats page. A lot of guys with ERAs lower than their FIPs and XFIPs. So this is a team that has a lot of regression potential, particularly on the pitching side, and particularly because of Wilson Contreras and his poor pitch framing metrics. So that's why people have soured on the Cubs. I've soured on the Cubs. I like their season win total under 88.5. That's not to say I think they'll be a team with a losing record like Pecota is suggesting, but something in the 85, 86 range for the Cubs would not surprise me at all for the 2019 season. Now, also, you look at the Cubs offensively, fourth in batting average, fourth in on-base percentage, both very good, but 13th in percentage. They were about league average in weighted runs created plus, 10th in weighted on-base average. They only had three guys with 20 or more home runs, only one guy with 30. That was Javier Baez, and you know, with his free-swinging nature, you sort of wonder if that's sustainable or not. But that's a big problem for the Cubs here. When you talk about the current state of Major League Baseball, teams are a little bit less dependent on the home run than they were 2 years ago, but it's still a major driving force for run scoring. You know, so because this is such a strikeout-heavy atmosphere and a strikeout-heavy environment, having a good batting average and a good OBP is only half the battle. You've got to hit for power to drive those runs in. The Cubs didn't do enough of that last season, and when you look at the projections for them, the offense is expected to stay about the same, but the pitching staff expected to drop off in a big way. So that's why there's a lot of skepticism and, quite frankly, a lot of pessimism about the Cubs here in the sabermetric community. Again, with people that view baseball in a more traditional sense, they're still going to recognize a lot of names on this team, and they're going to give the Cubs the benefit of the doubt. But if you look at some of the deeper metrics for this team, there are a lot of reasons to be concerned. We'll see how that plays out in a game by game. If I had to take the Cubs win total, I'd go under. It's not my favorite win total here in the division, but there certainly are a lot of concerns about the team there on the north side in Wrigleyville. We move on to the Cincinnati Reds here, 67-95 last year. Their fourth straight season with 94 or more losses. And that's what makes their season win total so fascinating here this year, is that their season win total is sitting at 79.5. So they have to be 13 games better than last year. Again, a team that's lost 94 games four consecutive seasons with a season win total basically right around 500. And this is a Reds team that had lots of movement in the offseason. You know, they picked up Sonny Gray, picked up Tanner Roark, Alex Wood, Yasiel Puig, Matt Kemp, Derek Dietrich, Zach Duke, Jose Iglesias. This rotation is much better, and the depth is far superior to what they had last season. And furthermore, you know, Jesse Winker's already there, but Nick Senzel will be there soon. Taylor Trammell will be there soon. Joey Votto said that this offseason he really dedicated to looking to replace his lost power from last year. So there's a lot of positives with this Reds team. There's a lot of reasons to see why people are optimistic about this team. And they basically overhauled the entire back end of the rotation. They've overhauled the lineup and the bench, and they've got some significant reinforcements coming from down below at some point here this season. Also, Luis Castillo last year, 341 WOBA allowed in the first half, 268 WOBA against in the second half, cut his slugging percentage against by 111 points, big spike in strikeout percentage. Castillo is the closest thing that the Reds have to a frontline ace starting pitcher. At his peak, he's probably a number two, but because he was so much better in the second half last year, he's a guy garnering a lot of steam out there from a fantasy standpoint and also from a betting market standpoint in terms of guys that are isolated to, you know, get a lot of line movement. And, you know, I had a listener question regarding my MLB picks and tips piece, or a reader question, I should say, about my MLB picks and tips piece and if I've tracked my closing line value. And no, I haven't, but regular listeners of the Bettors Box know that I can tell you pretty much in 90% of the games, 95% of the games even, which way the line is going to move. And a clear telltale sign is when you get a pitcher with a high ERA and a low xFIP. Well, last year, that was Luis Castillo. And over the course of the season, that ERA did gradually regress towards his xFIP. And anytime you get a guy with a high ERA and a low xFIP, Nick Pivetta, a clear example of this year for the upcoming season, you're going to get people that want to back that guy. So if you want to play Luis Castillo in Reds games here this year, play the overnight lines and then decide later in the day on game day if you want to buy off of it, play a little bit of arbitrage, or if you want to hold that position with your closing line value, because Luis Castillo going to be one of those guys that takes a lot of action, especially early on in the year with people looking to back him, expecting his ERA to continue to regress towards his FIP and XFIP. So definitely something you want to factor in the equation here. People will bet against John Lester early. People will bet on Luis Castillo, and you can see the reasons why. Because you see those FIP, ERA, and XFIP discrepancies, that's very important for you to keep in mind here. Something you definitely want to follow with the Cincinnati Reds. Now, the Reds, though, look, I mean, I get it. Again, their personnel is so much better this year. They played a lot better under Jim Riggleman than they did against Brian Price. And also, there are some reasons to believe that they just naturally see some positive regression. They were 10-29 in one-run games last year, which is really, really bad. Fewest number of wins in one-run games last season. That should regress positively a little bit. A lot of times, teams anywhere from, you know, plus six to minus six in one-run game record, a lot of teams will fall around 500 in that department. The Reds, obviously, well below 500 at 10-29. So this is a positive regression candidate, but with the strength of this division, with the historical results here for the Reds over the last few years, I have a very hard time taking this team to win at least 80 games in this division. The under does have some equity, but I do think they will be a much better team. I think they'll be a much more competitive team. And also, you know, again, we'll see where they are come, you know, the summer months, but with Senzel and Trammell likely coming up, nice little shot in the arm for them. You know, who knows? Maybe they could be a little bit of a dark horse contender here in the Central, but there is a dark horse contender I do like more than them. We move on to the Milwaukee Brewers here, 96-67 last year. One game, 163 over Chicago, won the division, got within one game of making it to the World Series. Their season win total here, 86.5. And this is a fascinating team for me. As somebody who studies the game from a sabermetric standpoint, the Brewers don't make sense. They have a lot of starting pitchers that are very pedestrian, very low strikeout rates, but guys that annually post a lower ERA than FIP and XFIP. So you would expect that guys like that would regress. And even last year, when you look at the starters, a 0.40 difference between ERA and FIP, one of the biggest in baseball. So hardline sabermetricians do not like this team at all. We saw their season win total market climb a little bit here this year, up from, I believe, 84.5 to 86.5. And that's a little bit scary for me because the quant community is not behind this team. And you try not to go against the quant community as much as possible, but also I feel like I've had a better frame of mind with the Brewers than a lot of people out there, because a lot of sabermetricians and a lot of modelers are very hardline. There's not much gray area. Everything is black. Everything is white. Well, I incorporate a lot more gray area into my handicapping, into my evaluation, because there are a lot of things that these metrics simply can't account for. And one of the things that the Brewers have done very, very well here over the last few seasons is contact management. Their starting pitchers are in the top 50 in average exit velocity against. You can't get hurt as badly if guys aren't making solid contact. So that's the approach that the Brewers have taken here, and it's worked out extremely well for them. Now, yes, they have an elite-level bullpen, and they've got a pretty decent offense as well, but these starters have been able to get by because they've got good command, and they're able to follow the pitching plans that are laid out for them by the front office and the analysts that are there at Miller Park. You know, this is just what the Brewers have done. You know, and this is something, I don't know why it's taken so long for this to happen. I mean, scouting reports have been around forever. But what the Brewers are doing essentially is they've gone very cutter heavy because cutters slide off the barrel of the bat. You know, you think you've squared up a cutter, all of a sudden it gets in on the handle, you get jammed, you roll over weakly on the infield or hit some weak ass fly ball. And the Brewers have really made their hay with that by using cutters in areas where, you know, hitters traditionally don't carry a high slugging percentage. So they've had a lot of success with that, and it's been a sustainable thing over the last two and a half years. Now, does the magic run out this year? I don't know. I will not be playing the Brewers over 86.5. I think it's just too high for comfort. But what I can tell you is that a lot of teams are starting to capitalize on this former inefficiency. A lot of teams are starting to look a lot more at contact management, at changing around pitcher arsenals. You look at the Yankees, for example. You know, their ballpark is a little league field. Well, what did they do to try and counteract it? They told their starters to stop throwing their fastballs as much. CC Sabathia has basically reinvented himself by throwing, you know, 35% sliders. You know, Patrick Corbin, another guy, 40% slider usage. All of a sudden, he becomes an ace with an elite level K rate. Teams are actively making these arsenal changes for their pitchers. The Brewers have done it with theirs across the whole staff. It's allowed them to have a lot of success in terms of limiting hard contact. So you'll see a lot of these Brewers starters get faded. You'll see a lot of people trying to go against the Brewers saying, well, this can't continue. Well, maybe it can because of what they're doing, because they're changing things. Baseball is all about the rush to find the next inefficiency. We talked about the Tampa Bay Rays a few weeks ago and about how, you know, they're hitting balls on the ground. They're going against the shift. They're going opposite field. They're looking to, you know, get a lot of traffic on base and see what happens from that, while other teams are trying to hit a bunch of fly balls. Well, ground balls go for hits more often than fly balls. Yes, fly balls go for doubles and home runs more than ground balls, which is sort of the give and take of the Rays' strategy. But, you know, teams are always looking for that next inefficiency. They're always looking for that thing that they can do better than somebody else or that they can find faster than somebody else. The Brewers, by utilizing these contact management techniques, have had a lot of success, and we'll see if it ends. But the thing is, for the Brewers, Corbin Burnes, Brandon Woodruff, they've got some higher upside starters coming up through the system right now that, you know, they get Jimmy Nelson back this year that, you know, also allow them to not only keep doing what they've been doing, but do so with a higher talent level, a higher chance of striking out some hitters here and there. So the Brewers are in a really, really good position. And offensively, you know, they've got Christian Yelich, the reigning MVP. Jesus Aguilar and Travis Shaw both hit 30 dingers. Lorenzo Cain with a .395 on base percentage. Yasmani Grandal, elite level pitch framer, good batter at the catcher position as well. They've got a lot of things to like here. What ironically enough concerns me about the Brewers is the bullpen. You know, you go to Corbin Burnes and Brandon Woodruff and Freddie Peralta in the rotation, maybe. You're taking away some of the bridge guys in this bullpen. Jeremy Jeffress slowed by an injury in spring training. I think that they've just burned him out the last couple of years. If they get Craig Kimbrell, my concerns melt away. And they have been in talks with Craig Kimbrell. Great Jeffress insurance policy. Good insurance policy for Corey Knebel as well. And, of course, they've got Josh Hader, who's, you know, the best left-handed reliever in all of baseball. So the Brewers are still going to be very good. I love what they're doing. I love what they continue to do. They've got some more pure talent and athleticism coming up through the system now from drafting and developing well. So there's more staying power than people think with this Brewers team. And again, I don't think a whole lot changes for them here this year. I still expect them to be good, maybe not as good as last year. But their season win total 86.5. Not a play I like necessarily, but again, I will not be rushing to fade this team like a lot of metrics heavy handicappers will be. The Pittsburgh Pirates, 82-79 last year. Season win total here this year, 77.5. This is my NL Central dark horse. This is my Cincinnati Reds. I really like this team. Jameson Taillon had elite numbers once he picked up that slider in late May and started throwing it a whole lot. I like Joe Musgrove. He's got some contact management skills. Same thing with Trevor Williams. Very low exit velocities against for those two guys. Chris Archer, we all know what he's capable of. Hopefully he can actually pitch to his FIP and XFIP. You know, I mentioned guys that carry a low ERA with a high FIP and a high XFIP over a long period of time. And sometimes you just have to accept that that's the reality. For Chris Archer, every year, he's kind of like Pineda, where his ERA is higher than his FIP and XFIP. One of these years, I hope that he pitches to his true talent level. It's very hard when you're a two-pitch pitcher, primarily just a fastball slider guy like he is. But you know, maybe the Pirates can do something different. And also, PNC Park, kind of on par with Tropicana Field, I would say. But certainly getting away from the road AL East parks, Toronto, Boston, New York, three of the top five parks for weighted on base average in terms of fly balls and line drives last year, that can only help Archer in the long run. So I like this rotation. You've got Nick Kingham coming soon. You've got Mitch Keller. I think Jordan Lyles eventually winds up in relief, but he's a passable starter. You know, PNC Park, a well-defined advantage for weaker offenses, for a weaker offensive team here in the Pirates. But, you know, even then, I mean, the Pirates offense could be a little bit better this year. Younghoe Kang is back. He's going to be the starting third baseman. Francisco Cervelli is a very good offensive catcher. Starling Marte is a good player. Gregory Polanco is still out, so that's a little bit of a concern. Hopefully he gets back soon. But the Pirates have some guys that one of the things about this Pirates team, they put a lot of balls in play. They kind of adopt the Rays strategy of as long as we don't strike out, we have a chance. And the Pirates do that here with a lot of guys that put balls in play. They do not have a lot of high strikeout hitters in this lineup. So that could create some interesting betting opportunities for us as the season goes along here against guys that are really reliant on strikeouts. You know, they're not going to strike out a lot. So they could be a good underdog play against some of those elite level starters that, you know, rely on the swing and miss. But ultimately what I love the most about this Pirates team, and I do like the starting staff. I think the lineup is okay. The bullpen is elite. This may end up being the best bullpen in baseball when all is said and done here this year. Felipe Vasquez, Kyle Crick, Richard Rodriguez, Edgar Santana, they got a bunch of guys there in this bullpen that are very, very strong. And I think ultimately Jordan Lyles ends up in relief. Bullpen arms for days here with this Pirates team. And again, you talk about the changing landscape of Major League Baseball and another reason why the Brewers have been so effective because they can five and fly with their starters and let the bullpen take care of business. The Pirates can do the same thing here if they want to, you know, because they have that level of depth in the bullpen. So love the Pirates over 77.5. I think the Pirates as a dark horse to win this division and win the NL pennant makes some sense. This is one of my favorite National League season win totals with the Pirates over 77.5. Finally, one more team to talk about here is the St. Louis Cardinals. Season win total 88.5. They were 88-74 last year. You know, you always have concerns about the Cardinals because from a health standpoint, it's one thing or another. Carlos Martinez already hurt. Michael Wacha's never healthy. Adam Wainwright's always hit or miss. But this is a team that has a very high floor and a relatively high ceiling because they have so many good players. Miles Mikolas, yes, he's a little bit of a regression candidate, but I wouldn't expect him to fall off. Jack Flaherty's a Cy Young dark horse for me. You know, they've got Austin Gomber, Dakota Hudson, Alex Reyes. They've got Daniel Ponce de Leon. They've got a lot of guys that are right there on the fringes of being major league starting pitchers. Looks like Hudson's going to be in the bullpen, probably be their primary setup guy. But this is a Cardinals team that just has so many options, so many weapons, so many really good players. It's one of those things, too, where offensively, it's the same thing. They now have a star in Paul Goldschmidt, which could really help them, obviously. But Matt Carpenter's a good player. Marcelo Ozuna's a good player. Paul DeJong is a good player. You know, Dexter Fowler, if he's healthy and comes back, he's a good player. Colton Wong, good player. Harrison Bader, good player. They've got a lot of guys where there aren't many weaknesses with this lineup, with this team. Yadier Molina, of course, very good player. They are trotting out guys that are average or better at every position on the field. And that's huge because a lot of teams don't have that luxury. A lot of teams will have to trot guys out there that aren't very good hitters, aren't very good defenders, you know, the glove first, no bat kinds of guys. The Cardinals don't have that. A lot of their guys are good offensive players and pretty good defensive players as well. So that's why this is a team with such a high season win total. Again, very high floor. Not sure what the ceiling looks like with all the pitching injuries and things of that sort. But, you know, Marcell Ozuna, big second half last year with a 364 WOBA. Now he's got Paul Goldschmidt in the lineup. Goldschmidt gets away from that humidor at Chase Field. He's a guy, you know, playing for a contract here as well. And contract year guys sometimes do get a nice little boost. Matt Carpenter had that big bounce back year last year. So the Cardinals are a very interesting team for a variety of different reasons. And again, I think with them, what's kind of attractive is that their range of potential results for the full season is much smaller than a lot of the other teams here. You know, if the Brewers are really good again, sure, they could win the division. But if things regress for them from a pitching standpoint, maybe they win 82 or 83 games. You know, I could conceivably see a 10-game spread for the Brewers. I could conceivably see a 10-game spread for the Cubs. Same thing for the Reds. And realistically, even though I like the Pirates, same thing for them. I feel like that window of expectation for the Cardinals is much, much smaller. They are probably the most trustworthy team in this division because they don't have many clear flaws. You know, Jordan Hicks was very good in the second half. You know, you've got Andrew Miller. We'll see what he still is. But they've got so many starting arms, like even a John Gant, that they can put out there in the bullpen that they can figure it out. You know, they have enough options to figure it out without having to go out there and make some kind of trade or, you know, sign Kimbrel or something like that, although Craig Kimbrel would be a nice fit for St. Louis. But, you know, again, like this is the team that has the smallest range of potential outcomes. And there's something to be said about that in a season win total market with a team that you think you can trust. So, and the NL Central is fascinating to me. I like all five of these teams in different ways. Should be the most competitive division in all of baseball here this year. But again, overall, I think the Pirates, probably my favorite season win total over. And, you know, I think the Cubs under is something that could be a worthwhile investment. Also, I think the Reds, just because, you know, somebody has to lose games here. And I would think it would be the Reds over the Pirates. But again, very strong division top to bottom. One I definitely enjoyed talking about. And one I will write about tomorrow at bangthebook.com with my MLB betting tips and players to watch. Then also do a quick one-off here to talk about the National League West tomorrow on Bang the Book Radio. All right, so with that, we got one more segment for this edition of Bang the Book Radio. It is that UFC predictions segment with Christian Pina of the Sports Gambling Podcast and also our bangthebook.com UFC writer. Again, this was recorded on Skype yesterday. This will sound different than the Blog Talk Radio recording here. I was hoping to get on Skype and do this, but didn't work out here this morning. Will sound different. I'll try and adjust the audio for the Blog Talk Radio segment as much as I possibly can. But in any event, here is that UFC Fight Night 148 segment with Christian Pina of the Sports Gambling Podcast. All right, I'm joined now by Christian Pina of Gambling Podcast and also our UFC writer over at bangthebook.com. Christian, how's it going today, man?
Eye of the storm out here in Vegas, man. We got MLB opening day at 2 a.m. We got March Madness in full swing, and we got a UFC event. No other place in the world to be right now. It's absolute heaven for a sports bettor. I cannot say enough good things in kind of the vibe that is about to overtake Las Vegas.
Well, our listeners are going to hear this on Thursday afternoon after I record some Major League Baseball stuff to either go before or after it. But I presume when March Madness rolls around, you stay the hell away from the strip as much as you can.
You know, it's so funny because as I've kind of been here year after year, March Madness to me, and specifically the NCAA tournament, when I say that, is really become more of something of a social event. Like, it's the one time a year friends kind of, you know, without question will be here. It's, you know, can kind of network, meet up with people I haven't seen in a while. So it's really gone. You know, I do kind of my bet placing well in advance, especially at openers via mobile apps or in person when there's not, you know, it's more the professional side. And then I just kind of enjoy it. And again, there's so many different things that you can take away from it, whether it's you want to be the, you know, have the social social aspect, which I have really kind of gravitated towards, you know, and be able to do that. And there's the other aspect of if you're a professional and you really want to make money at this, you need to kind of stay away from the drinking, stay away from whatever your vices are, and be able to look at that market live and everything like that. So you just really got to have your plan in place, be disciplined. And again, just one of the things that kind of separates, you know, professionals from recreationals. And there is nothing wrong with getting exactly what you want out of this, you know, whichever way it is.
Well, speaking of going places, I was in Nashville last weekend. That's where this week's UFC event is. Fight Night 148, UFC on ESPN Plus 6, or UFC Fight Night Thompson versus Pettis. We try to cover all of our bases here on the show at Bridgestone Arena. Obviously, should be a fun atmosphere for this one because, well, it's Nashville, and Nashville's a whole lot of fun to say the least. But as we look up and down this card here, Christian, what do you think about it overall?
Yeah, right. I feel like Nashville has kind of been the bachelorette party capital of the world at this point, kind of overtaking Las Vegas. But when we look at this card, casual fans will recognize the main event. I mean, Anthony Showtime Pettis, a legend in the sport, a huge underdog, and Stephen Thompson, you know, huge favorite, minus 435. And admittedly, I'm a little bit of a fanboy for Stephen Wonderboy Thompson. There's a heavyweight matchup that I think is a classic striker versus grappler that fans would naturally gravitate towards. Justin Willis, Curtis Blaydes, two names that have been in the heavyweight division and in a such a shallow division, that fight has a lot of implications. And more than that, when we look at this fight, past that, there's, you know, Macy Barber is a 20-year-old, maybe the best prospect in women's MMA at this time, at just, again, 20 on a 7-fight win streak after winning her UFC debut. And other than that, as we, again, we're going to go through this card, but there's a lot of underdogs that I think are very, very live, you know, to outperform their price and kind of, you know, give bettors a nice little reward here in the underdog market.
All right, so we'll start with that main event here, Stephen Thompson, Anthony Pettis. Maybe you've tipped your hand a little bit here talking about how much you like Stephen Thompson, but also minus 435, minus 440 over at DSI Sports because we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon. Stiff price to pay here for the favorite.
Yep, it really is. And Thompson, again, coming off the Woodley trials and tribulations, had an injury. Look, to me, again, I know I take a little bit of a different stance when it comes to fighters that I really love to get behind, the Stephen Thompsons of the world, the Tyron Woodleys of the world. And, you know, casual fans hate their style. It's incredibly boring, you know, Sergio Pettis to a degree. But the thing about it is these guys have built their games. And if I would liken this to, you know, Floyd Mayweather, again, the repeating theme that you will always hear me talk about is fight IQ. Tyron Woodley usually has the best fight IQ. Stephen Thompson, in my opinion, has the second best in all of mixed martial arts. Daniel Cormier, probably number one. I would probably say those guys two and three now that I think about it. John Jones is certainly in there in terms of the style of fight that they dictate and what they do. But Stephen Thompson, much like Woodley outside of Usman, and we talked about that one in particular, is Usman just may do what Woodley does better, push a higher pace. And when you point fight like this, pace is always going to be the issue because, again, when you're not being a high-volume striker, you can, you know, the fans are going to boo. That can get in a judge's head. And that really is what cost Stephen Thompson against Darren Till. Regardless, I still believe, again, maybe that's just the fan in me or the better in me at that point, that he won that fight. If he didn't get knocked down in that final round, he would have won a clear decision. And I understand that the UFC was trying to push Till up the ladder and they did not want to have another Stephen Thompson, Tyron Woodley, you know, quote unquote, boring snooze fest. But this is Stephen Thompson. He's going to do exactly what he does in that octagon, in my opinion. He's a world-renowned kickboxer, the best, you know, top three fight IQ in the game, and whatever you do best, he takes away. Anthony Pettis at this stage of his career, why is he such a big underdog here? He's in this for the love of the game at this point, you know, much like an Anderson Silva. He's there to put on a show for his fans and kind of go out on his shield, make his money while he can in this sport. And I don't think there's a, you know, a title run left in him by any stretch of the imagination. And this is two guys that the casual fan will certainly understand. This is a way to get Stephen Thompson kind of back on track and kind of, you know, up in the right direction over, you know, a guy who's just been such a legend in the sport like Anthony Pettis. And I mean, Pettis, in theory, when you talk about path to victory, you know, could try to take this fight to the ground and you know, do it that way. But Stephen Thompson's, you know, much like Woodley, his takedown defense is just so impeccable. It's really hard outside of a fluke transition knockout, you know, classic Anthony Pettis off the cage type of scenario, fluke knockout, to see, you know, Anthony Pettis getting the victory here. This should be Stephen Thompson in a what I would call a vintage Wonderboy performance.
Well, and as you look at Anthony Pettis here, I mean, won the lightweight championship way back on December 6, 2014, lost it in the next fight to Rafael Dos Anjos. He's 3-6 in his UFC fights since winning that championship. This feels like it's kind of a common theme with guys that, you know, had the strap, lost it. It seems like it's really, really hard for them to get back to that level. I don't know if they realize that they're not invincible anymore or if it's just the punishment that they've taken. But, you know, Pettis is a guy that really has fallen off dramatically.
Yeah, he has. And again, I think that we always talk about, we look at age and you don't realize, you know, that Stephen Thompson is 4 years older than Anthony Pettis, but we got to talk about fight years. And I know Stephen Thompson, again, decorated kickboxer, one of the best kickboxers in the world, whose game, you know, transitioned to the mixed martial arts world impeccably. But Anthony Pettis, in terms of fight years, I mean, 28 pro fights to Thompson's 20 or 17 or 18, whatever it is. So fight years, there is a remarkable difference. And there's just the wear and tear wears on you at that stage. And again, not to sit here and say it's all about the age. It's about what you've gone through in that octagon and fight years, and which is, you know, not that these are connected, but it leads me to, you know, these active fighters, the Donald Cerrone's of the world. It's just so incredible to be that active and to be still operating at a high level. But as we always say, Father Time is undefeated. And I think Anthony Pettis is getting towards the end, which, you know, in theory is good for him at, you know, this age. He still has his whole kind of life ahead of him at 32. I mean, my God, but just to be through the wars, to be at the pinnacle of the sport like that, I think it's kind of come and gone for him a little bit. There's been, you know, his brother was always, you know, Sergio Pettis has always been kind of the up and coming one, had some road bumps and stuff like that, but Pettis has kind of done his thing. And I think that the fight years have just kind of caught up to him at this point.
What do you make of Pettis returning to welterweight for the first time in 11 years? How do you think that affects him in this fight?
Yeah, it's an unknown, and we always talk about, you know, how I don't like to bet on those type of unknowns. It could be, we saw this with Cerrone, it was a career resurgence. I mean, in theory, is it out of the realm of possibilities? No, I think this is an incredibly tough matchup for a guy like Pettis to test that at. It's just a way that, you know, again, whether it's, you know, when we look at this for guys making weight, guys cutting weight, putting on weight, at this stage of the career, guys tend to do what is easiest. And again, we've even seen this as we get on to Macy Barber at 20 years old, switching up weight classes because of a tougher weight cut. Luis Pena, the same exact thing. You can only do it for so long, and you can only deplete your body or put on that weight for so long. So again, at this point, I think I would liken it to just trying to be as comfortable in there as possible. When you, again, maybe he's starting over in this division, you know, in terms of, you know, not being ranked, all that type of stuff for sure, but he's getting paid for a UFC main event. And I think he just wants to be as comfortable and be able to put on the best show as possible rather than dedicate his whole life to, you know, going on a title run, cutting that weight. So I think it's just a comfort thing and, you know, being able to be in the best situation, regardless of what that means for the future of starting over in a division.
All right, so we look at this heavyweight fight here between Justin Willis and Curtis Blaydes. Curtis Blaydes, his only two career losses in his professional MMA career, both Francis Ngannou. And when you get knocked out by a pissed off Francis Ngannou in 45 seconds, you can kind of overlook something like that, I would think, as we head into this fight. Meanwhile, Justin Willis has rattled off 8 wins in a row, including 4 straight in the UFC. So Blaydes a minus 285 favorite here in this one.
Yeah, I mean, Curtis Blaydes just has to be happy that it's not Francis Ngannou standing across from him, like you said. And look, here's the thing with Blaydes. This is striker versus grappler. Willis does not have the power, but I mean, again, who does have the power of a Francis Ngannou in this division, right? He is, you know, and Blaydes has been, this is striker versus grappler. Willis, the striker, Blaydes wants to grapple. And as you saw, despite, you know, if your name is not Francis Ngannou, Blaydes is able to, you know, his chin held up, and it held up incredibly. I cannot believe he survived that onslaught from Mark Hunt, was able to come back and utilize his wrestling. Should be the same type of situation here. And again, it's, you know, Willis is something of a one-trick heavyweight pony. Granted, that has given him all the success in the world. We saw that with a guy like Francis Ngannou until he was wrestled, you know, he was the stylistic matchup change, like a guy like Stipe. Now Blaydes is probably one of, if not the best wrestlers in the division outside of Stipe Miocic. It's just that there's different levels to this. So the way that I would say Willis doesn't have Ngannou's power, Blaydes doesn't have, you know, for example, Stipe's wrestling. And again, we're talking about guys that's the pinnacle and the elite of each one of those, whether it be wrestling or striking. So it's a little bit different. Both of these guys, this is almost a little bit of a poor man's version of a Francis Ngannou versus Stipe type of situation. It really is. So it makes for a great fight. I would not fault anyone for taking the underdog here. I just think that this one is, you know, Blaydes has shown, unless you're an Ngannou, he can take a punch. And that Mark Hunt fight really, really showed me a lot. Would I be shocked if Willis knocked him out? Absolutely not. Would I fault anyone for taking the +235 shot? You could probably even bump that up a little bit, you know, if you got Willis by knockout, although it's probably built into his prop market for sure. Blaydes likely to wrestle his way to a decision here, make this a very boring fight. I think the over makes some sense if you're going to back Blaydes, especially if we can get a 1.5 in the marketplace. And on the other side, I think, you know, Willis inside the distance type of props make some sense as well. So really just different paths to victories here. One is wrestling his way to a decision, and Willis would be the knockout, in my opinion.
Well, and again, recording this here on Wednesday, so we do have a shortage of betting options out there and available. And, of course, these lines will be moving around as well with weigh-ins and seeing how the fighters look and all that type of thing here. So I do apologize for that. But with March Madness and everything going on here this week, and both Christian and I being big baseball guys, you know, very busy time of year to say the least. Something you mentioned, I don't know if it was off the air or if you mentioned it in the intro to the segment here. This is a fight that you think has some relevance and some potential ramifications in the heavyweight division.
Yeah, it really does. You know, this is a very shallow heavyweight division at this juncture of time. And so when you're, when that becomes the case, there becomes an obvious need to input, you know, new talent. And so it can be a quick fall from grace, but the way that you can come back up is very quick on the other side. So it's a really big kind of give and take here for sure. This fight was likely to set up a big name fight for the winner, in my opinion. I'm not sure that the title is up for grabs after this, just because there's so many different moving parts to the DC Lesnar, DC Jones. I mean, there's so many different ways that they can go with this, but this is likely to be, you know, one fight away from a title contention type of fight eliminator. But again, it's a really big, you know, I think that Ngannou really almost got himself back on track in his last couple of fights for sure. You know, if Blaydes was to win this, I think that you can make a very strong case for him. And that would present, you know, a wrestler versus wrestler type of matchup with a guy like DC in theory, which is a very interesting matchup because chain wrestling is noticeably unpredictable. There's transitions, there's limbs falling everywhere. Now DC is on another planet when it comes to this. But Blaydes, again, is absolutely no slouch. So it certainly makes some sense. I think that if Willis is able to knock out Curtis Blaydes, I think you have to start taking him seriously with this mountain of victories. Now, granted, they have been against what I would call nobody really of note, to be completely honest. But it's something that nonetheless you cannot hold a shallow division up against him. So definitely makes some sense here, again, for the underdog, but it's just a path to victory type of situation for me. And I will always favor, you know, going against the one trick pony aspect of that, despite the fact that it has, you know, burned me a little bit going against, you know, a Bermudez or guys that have one thing and one thing only or one path to victory. I'll just always go with the guy who has more paths to victory.
So only one heavyweight fight on this card. There's also only one lightweight fight on this card, McDessie and Pinedo. And I think you've got a pretty strong opinion here on this one.
Yeah, I really do. I favor the dog here. Jesus Pinedo plus 265. The price is just too long. Pinedo only entering his second UFC fight, and I think that that is really the reason. When you look at this, I mean, he has... McDessie has fought absolutely everybody. He has all the experience in the world, and I understand why this is, you know, why it's lined this way. I just think that this actual fight is much more closer to, you know, a slight favorite for him. Pinedo is aggressive. He is so long. It's... You know, he has a six inch reach advantage in this fight. And if he is able to use his size the way he has done time and time again on his, you know, six fight winning streak extended to seven after a unanimous decision over Devin Powell, all the guy does is win. And there's something to be said for that. And guys with size and that reach are absolutely, you know, miserable to deal with. And when you can get them at an underdog price, I think that win or lose. And again, you know, I feel that this fight is a lot closer, but I'd be shocked if the, you know, plus 235 underdog lost or plus 265 underdog lost. No, but in the long run, I think I'm going to, you know, again, it's not as if you have to hit 52.8% of your bets when you're betting underdogs. The UFC, the second highest underdog sport in the world for fighters to come in like that. This reach advantage is going to be his best ally, a much stockier version of McDessie up against him. Sure, the crafty veteran could weather the storm, but when you look at this from a size perspective, a reach perspective, a momentum perspective, I just think this is a lot closer fight than the line indicates at plus 265.
Well, and that's the thing here about really any money line sport, and this is something that I'll talk about during the baseball season as well here, in the sense that, look, you've got a plus 265 dog here, which the implied probability of that, 27.4%. So if this guy's winning this fight, you know, 3.5 out of 10 times in your mind, there's value, there's equity in taking that price. And that's exactly what you're talking about here in the sense that, look, over the long term, will he lose more often than he wins? Yes, he probably will. But if you think he can win this fight 35 or 40% of the time, there's some equity in taking that price. And that's what the concept of value really means.
Completely agree with you. And I really do make this closer to right above, you know, just above over 4 out of 10 times. And that, you know, I'm so happy you brought up that word value, because it's a word, much like the word unit, that I think is the most misused word, along with the word sharp, in this industry. Look, there's no value in a losing ticket. I understand that. And I've really felt that way when it comes to the futures markets. Whatever, you know, if I give you, you know, whoever you feel the word, the Buffalo Bills, if I give you 1,000,000 to 1, but you don't know how to hedge it, you don't know how to properly deal with that value that you have, you know, that equity that you've accumulated, there's truthfully no value in it. It's going to be a losing bet for, you know, to win the Super Bowl or whatever, you know, long shot team. So to me, when you're talking about straight money line play, you have to, you know, this really comes into it with trends as well. If you can make the conscious decision to play these type of situations every single time and not pick and choose and just play one, you know, set of underdog, you know, one underdog on the card and not the others that you feel the same way about, and you go, you know, maybe you go 0-1 only betting Pinedo versus McDessie, but there's a couple underdogs on here, you know, Pena you could bet, Formiga, maybe you go 1 out of 2, 1 out of 3. It goes back to the same things we talked about. This is why I picked against Greg Hardy. It's just the unknown. I can't lay a whatever that was -500 on a debuting UFC fighter who has had no real experience. Did I fully expect that bet to lose? Yes. Should it have lost? You know, it was a technical decision. I could argue that that was the inexperience of him for a DQ, and that goes into the inexperience factor. So there's so many different things that go into it, but you have to make that conscious decision to take that value every single time that you see it, and not just pick and choose.
Yeah, absolutely. You couldn't have said it better myself. And let's move on to that flyweight fight between Formiga and Figueiredo. And again, this sounds like one where you've got a little bit of an opinion.
Yeah, and this price has certainly moved a little bit. I think that the market kind of agrees with me here on the underdog of Jussier Formiga. Look, this is what the market as it's settled in right now. I mean, Formiga was, I believe, a +140 all the way down to +110, Figueroa -140. This is what I would call a true definition of a pick'em fight. So I certainly understand people gobbling up that value. I mean, Formiga is looking for his fourth win in a row. Figueroa has breezed through everybody in his path. I really understand that. But Formiga will be looking to use takedowns, keep this fight grounded, while... on the other side, Formiga will be looking to end this fight along the way with his hands. And so it's a very, you know, striker versus grappler cliche matchup, but it's, you know, two guys that are really, really in what I would say the best form that they've been in a very long time as they've come up. Formiga, again, some of the best grappling in the division, black belt Brazilian jiu-jitsu, gives him, you know, he's a submission machine, 10 submission wins along the way. And when you're, you know, that is, it cannot be understated. And when, you know, Figueroa has the striking advantage, but as we've seen time and time again, number one, this is at this weight, I think it's a little bit different, but I think that these tend to be finished along the way, whether it is a knockout or a submission. But there's more paths to victory here for sure. Formiga could submit him. Formiga could win a decision. On the other hand, Figueroa could win a decision. I think it's a lot less likely. I think it's Figueroa by knockout. But again, at this weight, it's obviously a little bit, you know, a little bit iffy to try to take stuff inside the distance. But on the other side, you're likely to get some pretty good odds for, you know, that type of outcome to happen. So to me, it's just, this is a true definition of a pick'em fight. I had it lined about -110 each way. And I just think that Formiga is, the price isn't exactly right. You can certainly try to work an arbitrage at this point for sure, and kind of manipulate the market that way. I'm not sure how much handle, you know, this particular fight will get in the midst of a baseball or March Madness type of setting. So it may go a little bit under the radar, but it doesn't take much to move the market in truth. But to me, it's just taking that value again in somebody that I feel has at least the more likely outcome of path to victories happening, where Figueiredo has, you know, the knockout for sure. I understand in theory, because he is just becomes, you know, such a well-rounded fighter. But Formiga to me is just such an up-and-coming rising star in this sport.
Luis Pena is a big favorite here in the -265 range against Steven Peterson. This one in the featherweight division, two of those. This is the only one on the main card, even though the entire card on the same ESPN Plus network. What do you think about Pena as a big favorite here?
Yeah, I really do favor Luis Pena. This is something that is, look, this is probably going to be, for anyone that's going to tune into this fight, you're not going to believe the size difference that you are going to see when you see Luis Pena step into this octagon. He is going to hell of a time making this weight. I think that is something that cannot be understated. And again, as we are recording this a little bit early, there's, you know, different thought processes. Would I be thrilled if he forfeits 20% of his purse and decides that he is just going to go in there at his comfortable weight and, you know, potentially put on a fight of the night? I would be absolutely thrilled. And it's a price I would be more than comfortable laying with Pena. Look, he is 6'3", 5 inches taller than Peterson and owns a six inch reach advantage. That is combined with his insane volume of pace and his ability to finish people via submissions. Peterson, when you look at this, Patterson is probably one of, he's a little bit, I would say more well-rounded. He does, if you were to rate them across the board, he may grade out in some people's eyes a little bit higher just because he's a little bit more polished in certain areas. But Pena is, to me, this size advantage. You'll hear people talk about tall man defense, and that could certainly apply here. But Pena has time and time again used his size the right way. You know, John Jones is the classic example here that you'll always see talked about, and how to utilize size the right way. But Pena has a little bit, or Adesanya, but you know, Pena has a little bit of that. I'm not certainly trying to compare the two, but at 25, if he's able to make this weight, there is a, you know, he's going to be far and away the biggest guy in this division in physical tools perspective. I think that this one is Pena, really do.
All right, so the first fight technically of the main card here, you tipped your hand a little bit with this one earlier, but I certainly want to expand on this thought and on this fighter some more. Macy Barber, she's a -245 favorite. Again, this is as of Wednesday afternoon when we're recording. What is so special about this girl that she's, you know, got this this potential rise in her?
Yeah, she was an unbeaten strawweight. I mean, 7-0 in her career at 20 years old. Not only that, she has finished all but one of her fights and is via knockout, and is coming off a knockout in her UFC debut against Hannah Cyphers, who is one of the most durable women in the division. JJ Aldrich, on the other hand, she is coming to flyweight, 3 straight wins. I understand that. I don't totally fault the line being, you know, this high. But Macy Barber is just on another level. I have not seen, and admittedly, I was a little bit wrong on a girl like Caitlin Chikagan, Pollyanna Viana. You know, these girls can have all the talent in the world. Now, granted, none of those girls had the finishing power that we've seen out of a 20-year-old Macy Barber, who is likely to be the talk of the division within a very short amount of time. Again, you've seen kind of a change in the way, you know, the evolution of mixed martial arts is moving towards, you know, finishers within the women's divisions. And I think that's a note to the ESPN deal. I think that's a note to trying to get the casual fan. But you've seen it time and time again. We've talked about at length about women's overs here. That's, you know, a very dangerous proposition when you're talking about a girl like Macy Barber, who puts on a suffocating pace. She closes distance. She has great wrestling, very strong. She is, again, honestly, and again, I thought this a little bit like a girl like Caitlin Chikagan, Pollyanna Viana. Macy Barber is probably the best prospect I've seen in a very long time in women's MMA. And that's not, you know, a knock on anyone. I'm not trying to say she's better than, you know, the elite of this sport, the Shevchenkos, the, you know, Tisha Torres's, the Nunes, the Cyborgs. It's just, this is obviously a very different 125, you know, class than that as well. But Macy Barber could be the headlining, finishing act in this division in a very short amount of time, if she's able to keep this up and stay focused and put it all together.
So is 245 just too big of a price for you to get involved here though?
I think Macy Barber inside the distance, you know, makes some sense. I think a Macy Barber knockout prop makes some sense, certainly. And again, I don't know kind of what the juice is going to be at for this, or where even the round prop would be hung at 1.5 or 2.5. If it's, you know, this is treated like a regular, 2.5 women's fight, and the under 2.5 is lined at +300, I would likely take a little bit of that under, just knowing that that's not the true implied, you know, total when you talk about path to victory for a Macy Barber. That being said, Aldrich is crafty. Look, she's not going to wow anybody. She is, you know, 7-2. I understand that. Again, if you want to fade the hype and fade the prospect of the hype machine within the UFC, won't fault you for taking that over 2-1 price on a experienced veteran like JJ Aldrich. And maybe this is just the biggest test and Macy Barber does take her to decision. I mean, what it's, you know, it's a little bit of 40% ROI. I understand it. I think an open parlay with Macy Barber certainly makes some sense in this spot that we've talked about as well. I think this meteoric rise, if the inevitably she, you know, Barber's going to lose. And again, she's 20 years old. I'm not trying to hype this girl up like she is coming, you know, this is coming soon for her. But this is, you know, somebody who's on the right path. And it would take somebody with much better skill set than just kind of the, you know, average to above average that JJ Aldrich possesses.
All right, so we got 6 fights on the prelim card here. Anything stand out to you about the other 6 matchups?
Honestly, not really. I think you get your open parlay pieces out for Randa Markos versus Angela Hill. That's very likely to go to a decision for the over 2.5. You'll see that one kind of, out there in the marketplace. Chris Gutierrez, Ryan McDonald. This one's a little bit interesting in that you have a 10-0 fighter in Ryan McDonald at plus 170. So I think that some people would gravitate towards that. I personally would never, I don't like to lay this price of a minus 200 against an undefeated fighter, especially when they're this low on the mid card. You certainly want to look to fade those guys in the right situations when there's a do factor for your first UFC loss that inevitably will come. But I think that in this spot, it's probably warranted. Gutierrez certainly is much better in just about every area that I grade. McDonald has fought really absolutely nobody on the regional scene, does not fight in a great promotion, and his defense is non-existent here. So I think this one's probably ends up being Gutierrez inside the distance. But truthfully, outside of that, again, speaking about that, Markos, Angela Hill, if you want to take a little bit of an underdog price on Markos at plus 125, just knowing that this fight is so likely to go to a decision, and these are always these gross split decisions, there's certainly always going to be value when you can take a woman with a fighting chance, to get to a decision and one that's not likely to stop along the way.
Christian Pino, who's working, you can find on the Sports Gambling Podcast. Also find him at bangthebook.com with his UFC Fight Night 148 preview, and on Twitter at Christian Pina, P-I-N-A. Appreciate the time, as always, man. Thank you so much for joining me. We'll talk to you again next week for yet another event.
All right, man. Good luck with everything in your baseball and UFC world and March Madness upcoming this weekend, man. We'll talk soon.
All right, there you go. Good thoughts from Christian on that UFC Fight Night 148 segment. Whether you call it UFC on ESPN Plus 6, UFC Nashville, UFC Fight Night 148, whatever you call it, good preview there, good breakdown. Also, make sure you read his preview over at bangthebook.com. Finally, last thing I want to mention here, NCAA tournament starting today. Obviously, it's already underway for those listening to this show. A lot going on Friday and Saturday and Sunday in college basketball. PropSwap.com/BTV. You definitely want to check this out, especially if you're holding some futures tickets where you don't like the draw going forward. You're a little bit concerned about maybe an injury situation that's kind of out there, something like that. You can sell those futures tickets over on PropSwap, or you can be a buyer in 12 different states. PropSwap.com/BTB, even if it's not college basketball, NBA, NHL futures, Major League Baseball futures, some NFL props and futures out there already as well. So again, PropSwap.com/BTB, a marketplace for your futures and props tickets. Again, coming up on our Friday abridged edition of Bang the Book Radio, I'm going to chat about the National League West. I'll see if I want to add anything else to that. I'll make sure that you tune in for that. So thank you very much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.